CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. The Marcus Evans CFO Summit, which will be hosted May 18th through 20th, 2011. CFOs will attend strategic conference sessions, including special guest speaker Lorraine Chilvers, host of CFO Radio. This networking event presents a unique opportunity to develop meaningful and valuable business relations. For more information, please contact Christina Sears at 305-358-6138. Email her at mediapartners@marcusevansmi.com or visit cforadio.com for more information. And finally, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News published by CFO Magazine, there is an article on mid-sized companies seeing growth ahead. And as they say, growth dominates the agendas of mid-sized companies. A new survey by Deloitte indicates about 80% of respondents on the survey see their company's revenues and profits growing this year, and nearly 70% plan to hire, according to the survey of 527 top managers at US-based firms with between $50 million and $1 billion in revenues. So that's great news for us in the economy. However, the economic uncertainty and weak market demand do continue to be top concerns. Few of those surveyed expect outsized growth in the economy as a whole, with most anticipating an increase in GDP of 3.5% or less. The survey results show a great deal of optimism grounded in some level of caution, says Tom McGee, managing partner of Deloitte Growth Enterprise Services. So where will the growth come from? Well, the most popular growth strategy for mid-sized companies remains expanding within the U.S. markets, named by 56% of the respondents. Along those lines, about 35% said they were likely to make an acquisition in the coming year, mainly in the United States. Indeed, Lazy Days, a Florida-based recreational vehicle dealer with more than $500 million in annual revenues, is in the process of making its first ever acquisition, buying a Tucson-based dealer out of bankruptcy court. And they quote, "Valuations are still low, and this looks to be a way to bring in some customers without cannibalizing our existing business," says CFO Randy Lay. But over time, companies in this revenue range expect to be more reliant on overseas markets, the survey indicates. Only 68% said the United States will be a major source of growth in the next 3 years, compared with 81% who said the United States drove growth in the past 3 years. And in summarization, about half of mid-sized companies currently have no revenue from overseas, a percentage that is expected to drop to 35% in the next 3 years. Well, welcome to CFO Radio. Today, our guest is Jim Wanserski. He is the incoming president of the local chapter of Financial Executives International, one of our sponsors. Jim is a management consultant in the area of turnarounds. He has held management and executive positions at Sprint, Telecom USA, and MCI. He's had consulting management in the specialty telecom office of Arthur Andersen Business Consulting, and turnaround consulting position with Morrison Anderson, a turnaround firm. And at one of Jim's turnaround projects, he served as COO for a regional wireless company, which was ultimately sold to Dobson Wireless. And he provided consulting services as part of two different wireless transactions, AT&T's acquisition of Dobson and Verizon's acquisition of Rural Cellular. Well, Jim, most recently you were nominated by the United States Department of Justice and appointed by two different federal judges in the District of Columbia to serve as the trustee in AT&T's acquisition of Centennial Wireless, and then also trustee of the Hold Separate Assets Trust, part of Verizon's acquisition of Alltel. Jim is an independent management consultant. He's a published author and a speaker on a variety of topics, including fraud, ethics, and other operational topics. Jim has a BS and an MBA in accounting from Rockhurst University. Well, wow, Jim, that's an awful lot by way of introduction. Very much a welcome to the show.
Lorraine, thank you, and I'm pleased to be here.
Well, Jim, let's start at the beginning. What was your first paying job, and how did you arrive at your current position? How did you get from there to here today?
Well, I don't want to go all the way back, Lorraine, but I grew up in a large family in the heartland of America, 8 children in the family. I remember finishing up high school in the spring, and my mother would say, look, Jim, you can do 2 things. You can either work for me this summer, and I can make it pretty painful, or you can go get a paying job and take care of yourself. I obviously chose the latter, went to work in the fast food industry, obviously, as a high schooler, and took the job from there. So it was an easy choice to make, now that I remember that. Along the way, I ended up, like you said, went to school in Kansas City at Rockhurst, and ended up going to work for what is now Sprint. I remember I started as a staff auditor in the internal audit department. So I guess part of my heritage is not only accounting, but auditing along the way as well. Did a host of things with United Telecom, including coming back to run internal audit at United Telecom, and ended up finding a number of fraudulent activities at the firm, which were quickly fixed. Ended up leaving United Telecom, went to work for Telecom USA, as you had mentioned. 18 months after moving my family to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, we got acquired by MCI and moved to Chicago. Along the way, during a reorganization, I moved with MCI to Atlanta, where I took over all credit collections, commercial credit collections for MCI. Ended up leaving about a year and a half before Bernie Ebbers came in and acquired MCI. So for once in my life, the timing was good. Went to work, figured I'd go to work for a good company then, and ended up joining consulting with Arthur Anderson and stayed there until they basically imploded. Then went to the turnaround firm, as you mentioned, and then I've been doing consulting since I left Morris Anderson a few years ago.
Well, Jim, let's maybe start with that first role. You mentioned that was a pivotal role, and you went on to lead the internal audit. Let's start with the role that you had at that United Telecom, which then became Sprint. That was a stepping stone for you. What specifically drew you into it, and what did you like about it?
I had some choices coming out of college, Lorraine, and one of the things that attracted me to again, what is now Sprint, is being able to join the internal audit group. I felt like this was one of the best ways to learn the company and the business. The internal audit function, and this was some time ago, but it was robust. We had about 50 people who traveled the country, had multiple locations. Not only did we all do all the work for the public accounting firm on the testing side, we also did very much IT testing, both operational application and test decks is what we used to call them, basically testing transactions through the system. So I found that it was a wonderful way to not only learn the business, but to see a lot of different organizations within the company. And it really became a stepping stone, as you said, to being able to move into other operations, which, in fact, I did.
Now, interestingly enough, a lot of our guests on the show that have come through the ranks, as you have done to being an executive, have started either in public accounting auditing or internal auditing, and it seems that that's the pattern that you followed. Did that give you any access to particular people within the organization, particular mentors or anything like that that perhaps helped you look at, hey, I'd like to do that one day. I'd like to be that person.
Yeah, I think along the way, I ended up reporting to, at that time, the corporate controller who for some reason, I found a way to get along with him, whereas a lot of other people didn't. So that was helpful for me in that I almost sometimes became a buffer between him and the operations. But the other thing along the way is being able to report to the audit committee, meeting several people on the board of directors when I was running internal audit. That made a lot of good impressions, and I got to see a lot of different management styles, you know, in those audit committee meetings and how people handled some very tough situations, and some of which that I had to bring to them.
Now, were you ever in the boardroom in that capacity?
Not in that position, but certainly I was reporting to the audit committee twice a year and got to sit in on some of the board meetings.
That's great experience, particularly early on.
Very, very much so.
Great. Well, then let's jump a little bit, if we can. You have a strength of background in terms of turnarounds. What are the specific complexities of working in a turnaround situation? And perhaps as you touch upon this, maybe talk about the extent to which this is a regulated field.
Yeah, I think as I look back on my turnaround experience, first of all, I think it was the number of different things that I had done historically that really got me ready. I spent a lot of time in high technology and telecom, in all of the finance chairs, running a portion of IT along the way, finding fraud multiple times. So me joining a turnaround firm was actually a pretty natural transition. Just because of the variety of things you did. But in the turnaround world, basically, we are addressing problem companies. And so a company in trouble, typically it's the advisors that note the issue first. Many times management doesn't. So an advisor, the lawyers, the bankers, et cetera, will say, look, management team, we have a problem. Or the bank will come to the management team and say, look, your loan is underwater. Here are three names of turnaround experts. Pick one and have them in the building within 60 days. So walking into my first turnaround project, actually in upstate Michigan, serving as CEO of a wireless company, was a company that funded a large growth in building a wireless network in upstate Michigan. I think we called it vertical real estate. Managed to purchase a lot of vertical real estate for cell towers, et cetera, and never paid a dime of interest or principal on a large loan. So I walked into that with the bank consortium very concerned about how we're going to fix this. Ultimately, the bank was involved in doing a strategic sale, so I ran the operation for about 11 months, and it was successfully sold to Dobson. So again, looking at the regulatory side, it's really the banks coming in and say, fix this, here's somebody to pick, have them in the building, and we need to get going.
And to what extent is the court involved in that element of regulation?
Until it reaches a potential filing, really the court isn't that much involved, unlike, say, the trustee role. But until you're approaching a Chapter 11 filing, the bank or the creditor committee is typically not involved. So a lot of the turnarounds I did, there was things of value, there were things to be sold, there were things to be maintained. So the ones that I was involved in is really the banks and the advisors driving the action with the turnaround firm. We got close to filing a few times, but luckily we had some things of value that could be run until a good sale.
Well, you mentioned back there element of the trustee, and that doesn't happen, the court involvement doesn't happen until it becomes a trustee role. You have played the role a couple of times as that of trustee. First and foremost, what is a trustee? And perhaps just give us the backdrop as to how that is a little bit different.
Yeah, maybe the best way to talk about the trustee role, and certainly the ones I've been involved in, there have been a number of transactions here in the United States with the wireless companies acquiring other wireless companies. Obviously, there's some safety and scale. So a few years ago, an associate of mine that I'd worked with before, who happens to be now with the Department of Justice, called me and said, Jim, what are you doing? Now, Lorraine, I'm not a total idiot. When the DOJ calls, I answered very specifically, well, what would you like me to do? But what was happening at the time was AT&T was acquiring Dobson. And as a result of the deal, the regulators like to approve the acquisition subject to certain constraints. And so what happened in this particular case is the DOJ and the Federal Communications Commission approved the acquisition subject to terms and conditions. Many of those terms and conditions become, gee, in these markets, your market share is too high. These assets need to be set aside, put into a trust, and those assets have to be run by a trustee who serves basically as CEO of those operations until they're sold. So in this particular case, AT&T paid for Dobson, and the owners of Dobson received the proceeds. So the better the trust did, the higher the proceeds. So it's a good thing, but it's a way to approve a deal without having to wait until those disputed properties are sold.
So essentially, you're carving out a piece of the business.
Exactly.
Is that typically on a business unit or a business line, or maybe in the telecom industry, is it based on certain licensing in a particular state?
It follows the licensing and the territory, so you're exactly right. So because that's the way the licenses drive the territories, it's typically compartmentalized to some degree to reporting and customers and cell sites and things like that.
So in your capacity as trustee, is there particular reporting that you need to do? You're acting as that leader of the entire organization, and in carving out, I would imagine you carve out assets, certain people. Now you've got certain people on payroll that are part of that essentially new legal entity.
It's almost a legal entity, almost, but you've got designated employees, management team, cell towers, customers, systems, et cetera, that follow the territory. But essentially, the trustee is the CEO of the entity. You have a management team that runs the operation. Now, we are relying upon either the buyer or the seller to in a shared service environment to provide billing and customer care, et cetera, but you've got service level agreements. The biggest driver of this, though, is several court orders that are driven by the Department of Justice saying this is who has responsibility, this is how we're going to maintain the value and economic viability of the assets, because that's the objective of the DOJ and really the FCC is to maintain competitive assets and competition. So that's really the driver of the court order. And then we have monthly reports to the DOJ, the Federal Communications Commission, and many times to several state agencies if states are involved in it as well. So there's plenty of reporting, plenty of lawyers, and lots of things to take care of along the way. But most importantly, many times it's we need to keep the trustee happy. We need to make sure they're able to do their job according to the court order, and the buyer and the seller participate actively.
Sure, sure. Well, you mentioned the people aspect of payroll and employees being carved out. Is there an assumption when you come into an organization that you're going to cut heads?
That's certainly something that the buyer is looking at, economies of scale and all of those things. The management team of the trust and the employees of the trust, certainly they need to maintain their activities during the term of the trust until those assets are sold. And there's certainly a risk that, I may not have a job when this is over. One of the ways we try and reduce the uncertainty is to provide stay bonuses for those people so that they remain actively involved. And in many cases, though, the buyer of those properties is very interested in maintaining the salespeople, the network people, et cetera. So you can probably imagine who's typically on the short list and who's on the long list.
Sure. And your role is to have the evaluation of the employees such that, you know, the best for the team remain on.
That's right. Now, the biggest challenge we have had, though, is sometimes the people that get placed into the trust role running the trust properties, well, let's say the acquirer typically gets first choice, so we've had to argue rather vehemently sometimes to make sure we had the quality to run the trust, because I think it's harder because there's more uncertainty. So we've had to argue several different times, no, this isn't the right person to do this. This isn't the right person for that role. And you've got to take care of yourself in a situation like that. But again, ultimately, everybody has to follow the court order and maintain the competitiveness of the assets.
Sure.
And that's the people, too.
Sure, understand. Well, let's jump slightly in terms of some of the experiences that you have. And I know this is an area that you speak upon pretty regularly. Tell us a little bit about your experience in the area of fraud and irregularities.
You know, Lorraine, sometimes I've given over 50 speeches on fraud prevention and detection. I don't know. I know I can't be that smart, but I know I can't be that unlucky either. I have run into fraud just about every company I've worked at along the way.
I mean, the reality is picking up a pencil and taking it home. To some extent, it's a miniature fraud, you know, taking a couple of cans of water or Coke or whatever at the end of the day to take it home. It's all fraud.
It goes from cheating on expense reports to, major diversion of assets and everything in between, including kickbacks. So it's all over the place. But, yeah, for some reason, as a little guy from the heart of America, I have run into fraud so many times. Like I said, I can't be that smart, but I can't be that unlucky either. So, yeah, it's happened a number of times. In one particular case, I was on the stand for over 40 hours. I've put people in jail. I've gotten large restitution of assets. But as a finance person, the antenna just seems to go up. And so I think my background in audit, knowing the finance and the systems and how accounting is supposed to work, and quite frankly, having lots of contacts through the company, because you can't find it from your office doing spreadsheets. You've got to have contacts throughout the company. So I've always prided myself in not only knowing people, but knowing how the business works. And for some reason, people would pick up the phone and say, Jim, this strange thing really happened. Can you come talk to me about this? So I think along the way, I've uncovered fraud at least 10 different times. And actually, it included one of the recent trusts as well.
Interesting. Very interesting. And I understand that there's a certain element of confidentiality that we need to have you maintain regarding those. But we might get into a little bit more discussion about them. Perhaps talk to us in terms of your role. You're coming in, you're looking at the people, you're looking at the headcount. Clearly, you've got reporting that you need to do, and you're trying to run a business. In terms of the role that you've played and that you play today, explain your role and reliance on data and systems and how that comes into the role of turnaround and bringing a company through.
Lorraine, you're touching one of the priority things in my brain. Again, having spent a lot of time in the telecom business and high tech, in my opinion, you can't learn the business unless you understand the systems and how the data works. I think sometimes as finance people, if we would spend as much time learning the systems and how business works as we do learning how accounting and financial statements work, we could be dangerous. But I have always been a fan of I need data to make decisions. I used to call it give me actionable management information. I don't want the core stuff. Give me the information that helps me make decisions. And so I'm totally biased towards how IT works. I've led task forces on billing system issues along the way. So I have a soft spot for understanding systems and the data. And quite frankly, I've certainly purchased some beverages for all of my friends in IT to be sure I could have lots of congeniality with the people who are providing me the data.
And from my experiences in some of the roles that you also have played, telecom doesn't seem to have a particularly strong acumen for post-acquisition integration of systems. What you tend to find is that there are multiple billing systems and that there are multiple receivable systems, and then you've got the whole fixed assets, the inventory and the cash management and so forth. And essentially, you're at the end of the game consolidating multiple disaggregated systems that just simply do not talk to one another.
Lorraine, I have a feeling we've been at some of the same places.
We actually have.
Yes, we have. And I remember 40-some billing systems. But let me give you an example. I can recall upgrading, and I use that term loosely, upgrading to a new receivable systems at one of the telecom companies I was working for. I was running all commercial credit and collections. So we did this upgrade. A week after the upgrade occurred, we couldn't post electronically 40 cents of every dollar that came in. So I was on a weekly conference call with the CFO and the CIO, giving both of them a status of, well, what's the backlog today? And we started at several hundred million dollars and we worked it down. So you're right, in a systems environment, in a post-systems implementation environment, in a post-acquisition environment, you can't imagine the cleanup or the things that aren't anticipated. And so the people who get to deal with it in a post environment, you certainly learn how it works and you also learn what didn't work.
And in your role, you're disaggregating, you're splitting off or spinning off a part of the business. So in that capacity, are you also involved in making sure that the system setup is appropriate?
In the trustee environment, the systems are probably one of the most important things because they're typically serviced by the seller. It's the seller's systems until they get converted to the buyer systems. and it can be a challenging process along the way. But you're right, we've got to carve out the systems and the customers for confidentiality purposes, because the other side can't see what the trust is doing, and vice versa, and that is by court order. So the systems disaggregation and confidentiality and the way the things have to be operated is probably one of the most important things, because it's all over the court order, and let me tell you, the regulators require it, and there's been some problems historically.
Well, that being said, Jim, there's a huge amount that I can only imagine that is on your plate as you go into the organization, whether it be in the capacity of a turnaround consultant or manager and or a trustee. When you first go in, let's say perhaps as a trustee, what is the first aspect of the business that you look at?
I think the first thing that we have to address is, what's the management team? What's the quality? Who's being aimed at the trust? And as I said earlier, we want to make sure we've got quality to run this business in an uncertain environment. So that's certainly the first place we look. I think the second thing is making sure that the trust management team understands the court orders, because we are required by law to follow the court order. But certainly the management team is the first place. Then it's a matter of getting ready to run this disaggregated company that used to be a part of something larger. And how do we stay competitive, and how do we keep after our salespeople? Are we compensating correctly? Because one of the hardest things in a trust environment is keeping the employees motivated to remain competitive. And by law, we've got to keep those assets economically viable and competitive, and we're competing against everybody out there.
It's all back to people.
It's all back to people.
Well, are there any aspects of your position that as you go into these companies that your own decision-making is scrutinized? And in that capacity, I can only imagine that the scrutiny would come from some of those regulating bodies. Who is the overseeing body that's concerned with what you're doing, the financial statements, and the emergence that you're leading the company through?
In these trust environments, we're providing a monthly report to the Department of Justice and to the Federal Communications Commission, and like I said, occasionally to the states. And let me tell you, the regulators, having done all the analysis to decide which markets stay and which markets go to the trust, they know this business. They've done this a number of times. They've worked with a number of other people. They have demands on the buyers and the sellers. But you are basically executing the court order, and there's a lot of data. It's basically a small company. You've got all the reporting that you typically have, and you have all the extra reporting that the court order requires. And the regulators are very interested in making sure the value is maintained, that competitiveness is maintained, and there's lots of questions. But the point of it is, it's a good environment because it allows a deal to occur rather than waiting until those properties are sold to do the deal. It's done up front. So it is a good choice by the department, but there's lots of reporting involved, and quite frankly, there's lots of lawyers.
Funny, in the finance world, we tend to circle around lawyers, and lawyers tend to circle around us.
Bankers, lawyers, and accountants, what do you do?
There you go. It's a party. Somebody ring the pizza
right.
And so forth. Well, Jim, explain some of the mechanics of a turnaround.
Like I said, there's already a problem, or the advisors wouldn't be coming to management and say, here's three people, pick one. But typically the rule number one that I learned along the way from Morris Anderson and the other firms I've been associated with is cash is king. The first thing you do is a 90-day cash flow. You've got to understand the ins and outs of cash, because in a turnaround environment, you've got to be able to pay the important bills. You've got to be able to take care of maintaining some kind of operation while you're figuring out, what's of value, what needs to be sold, what needs to be shut down, et cetera.
And so, interestingly enough, if the previous management had taken the mantra, cash is king, perhaps you wouldn't have been in the situation you're in.
We probably wouldn't have been invited in. That's exactly right. So cash is king. And then it's a matter of you're analyzing the business plan, the forecasts. You're looking at the management team, who needs to stay, who needs to go. You're looking at what things you can sell, but ultimately you are brought in by the bank And that's the typical place. We probably got two-thirds of our business from banks because of an underwater loan. But obviously cash is the first place. And then it's a matter of maintaining value and then making decisions on, can we move to a sale? Do we move to a strategic sale or a financial transaction? Because that's a choice.
What are the differences?
Well, the differences are really a strategic sale would be, well, maybe even in the case of that first turnaround project I had. It was ultimately purchased by Dobson. So they were looking for a way to get into Michigan, which is where this turnaround firm client was. So, yes, we could have sold those assets just to somebody looking to get into the business, but the belief was we might be able to get a better deal by maintaining them for the 11th month of my COO role and walking that those properties in front of a larger wireless company, and that is, in fact, what ultimately happened. Now, I wasn't responsible for the sale, but I maintained it until the sale occurred. So a strategic sale is somebody looking to get into a new product line, a new territory, et cetera, whereas a financial deal is, I want to buy these assets, I don't want those, and let's close the deal, get out of here, and see you later. Good luck.
And in that capacity, are the employee base often secondary? Is it the assets that they're looking for?
It's typically the assets or the brand name or the customer base.
So is there always a buyer?
No, there isn't always a buyer. Sometimes, and that's where you get into a filing or dissolution or liquidation. And I've certainly done a few liquidation calculations in my time as well. But those are the options we don't like to talk about, but they in fact happen because maybe there just isn't an interested buyer and you end up liquidating.
Well, Jim, unfortunately, we are nearing the end of the show, and we have a tradition on our show to ask all of our guests the CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
Well, I talk about this in my fraud presentations, et cetera, and we kind of touched on it already, Lorraine. But in my opinion, you've got to have contacts throughout the company, IT, sales, operations, the shop floor, the managing floor. And typically, as a finance person, you know, we're kind of introverted. We don't like to talk on the radio or things like that. We're in our offices a lot. You've got to get out. You've got to meet people. So my point is, the eyes and ears and the knowledge of the business comes from anybody you can meet in the entity. And so I would encourage finance and accounting people to have lots of contacts within the operation. You're learning a lot of things, but then somebody's going to get curious about something odd, and they just might call you to deal with it.
Well, that is a fabulous tip, and we appreciate you being on the show. This is a thanks to Jim Wensursky, our guest today, for sharing his innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thanks go also to our contributor, CFO Magazine, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, please go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thanks also go to our sponsor, the Marcus Evans CFO Summit, which will be hosted May 18th to the 20th, 2011. CFOs will attend strategic conference sessions, including special guest Lorraine Chilvers, myself, host of CFO Radio. This networking event presents a unique opportunity to develop meaningful and valuable business relations. For more information, please contact Christina Sears at 305-358-6138, email at mediapartners@marcusevansmi.com, or visit CFO Radio for more information, and that can be found at cforadio.com. And thanks also go to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website can be found at financialexecutives.org. And we are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. Our guest today, Jim Wensursky, is the incoming president of that organization. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks to listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.